This time on Poll Hub, Joe Biden's awful August. In our new poll with partners NPR and PBS NewsHour, Biden hits a new approval rating low, even as many Americans approve of the concept of withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. They didn't like the way he did it, though. His approval of handling of COVID is dropping, too, just as things may be turning a corner on the vaccine front. We'll talk about that. Then we're talking with NPR correspondent Hansi Lo Wang about the census, specifically how what white is in the census may affect how we do polling. Really fascinating discussion there. Stick around for that. And finally, this being Labor Day weekend, Lee's fun fact is about Labor Day. Plenty to talk about, so let's get to it. And hi, everybody. Welcome to Poll Hub. I'm J.D. Dapper.
I'm Barbara Carvalho.
And I'm Lee Marinkoff.
Well, we certainly had a busy polling week this week, to say the least, with our national polling partners, NPR, National Public Radio, and the PBS NewsHour. And we were taking a look at what Americans think about some two really big issues that have been dominating the news for the month of August and now going forward into September. Afghanistan and the ongoing issues with COVID. But I'd like to start actually with something that we had talked about in a couple of previous podcasts, which was President Biden's approval rating really declining? We were seeing some drops in his approval rating over the last couple of months, not statistically, just numerical, but certainly August, the debacle in Afghanistan has really impacted what Americans think about how he's doing in office. Right now, we found that Biden's approval rating has dropped to 43%. Now statistically changed from our August numbers of 49%, and that's certainly a new low for the president. A couple of other points here too, though, is his handling or how people view his handling of foreign policy and the withdrawal of troops in Afghanistan are also underwater. 56% of Americans disapprove of how he is handling foreign policy in general, and 61%, 6 in 10 Americans, really disapprove of how he went about the withdrawal in Afghanistan. So guys, what does, I know we're going to get to the other issues shortly, but what does this mean for President Biden and really, you know, his presidency going forward?
I saw one thing I thought was interesting in the approval rate. First of all, the strongly disapproved went up substantially, whereas the strongly approved really didn't move.
Yeah, what were those numbers, Lee? Because that was dramatic.
Yeah, the number there was 30. The strongly disapproved went from 30 to 41, and the strongly approved stayed at 19. So you have a 2-to-1 strongly disapprove over strongly approve. So that's, again, another measurement, another metric on this. I thought that one of the things in looking at Biden, and obviously these could be very time specific, there might be an immediacy effect here because of the just the recency of the of these events. But
well, also we were polling right after the suicide bombing in Kabul, and then through that weekend into the following week, but through the weekend with the deadline.
And I thought was interesting, and I don't know if this will stay, but his base seemed a little rattled by all this. Democrats were down 5 points, and then independents went down 10 points, which Jay always points as the one that you want to keep your eye on, because that's the one that gets you into good numbers versus bad numbers. So I think it's going to be very important to see how things go in the future. I think he violated a cardinal rule of politics. Tim Russert used to say that, you know, say you're going to do it and say you've done it. And everything else is complicated. And I think right now he recently just came out with a new foreign policy. Well, maybe you wanted to start with the foreign policy redirection and then have the withdrawal as an example of it. And that might not have created the kind of, I mean, you know, they evacuated hundreds, I mean, thousands of people, tens of thousands of people. It was a huge evacuation, but that's not what the image that stands in people's mind.
So, Jay, is this just a political blunder, or you think this has some resilience?
Well, I think the thing about this is it is his approval rating dropping is because we ask questions that are somewhat granular about how how do people think he's doing on the economy around COVID or these things. And it's very clear, while we can't draw a definitive line, that this approval rating drop seems very suggestively to be linked to what happened in Afghanistan. So two things about that. One, what Lee talked about, when you say we're not going to leave anybody behind and 3 weeks later leave people behind, that's just bad politics, right? There's a lot of bad politics that happen here, but put the politics aside. It strikes me that when we look at where Americans are in Afghanistan, that there's a disconnect. The numbers that we see suggest, 70 or 71% think that what we did in Afghanistan was a failure.
And that's over the 20 years, though, Biden's recent.
Right. And when you look at what people think we ought to be doing, 37% say, well, we ought to, pull out all the troops. 38% say, well, we ought to pull out most of them and leave a few behind, which was kind of what we were doing. I think you get a sense that most Americans think that it was time to, by and large, get out of Afghanistan so that Joe Biden was actually doing what most Americans wanted. But the way that it happened is what's coming and biting him. I will just say, and I said this when his approval rating began to drop, and I said, let's see what happens a couple weeks down the line. I am dubious that this is anything permanent because of what the Supreme Court did last night as we record this. The Sunday shows are not going to be filled with Afghanistan. They're going to be filled with Roe v. Wade. That helps Joe Biden. That helps Democrats. And I think the point of that is not that it's not that Afghanistan shouldn't be something that he is judged by. It's that we live in a news cycle now that has so sped up over the last decade that almost nothing has staying power. And so I think the approval rating being down at 43%, which is not great, not good for him. It's Donald Trump territory. It's not good for him, but I am very dubious that it sits there for very long based on how quickly the events change.
Yeah, and to your point, Jay, I just would say quickly that, the pundit community, as soon as something like Afghanistan happens, the first thing people say is, does this sink the Democrats for the midterms? And that just be law. I remember hearing that the impeachment was going to be, hanging around Donald Trump's neck. Impeachment one, not two.
Yeah.
was going to be hanging around him for the midterm, whatever. Like you say, there's a new cycle effect here that moves rapidly.
Well, just a couple things on Afghanistan before we move on to the findings that we had regarding COVID. I think there were some significant things here. Jay, you mentioned that withdrawing from Afghanistan was certainly a popular position with Americans. And 61% of Americans say that Afghanistan really needs to determine its own future without our involvement there. Only about 1 in 3 believe the U.S. should stay going forward to be involved in that country in any way. And another thing, we found a Gallup question that had asked about refugees resettling in the United States over quite a number of decades. That started in 1939, I believe, with German refugees, and they've clocked it, decade after decade as we've had people come en masse to this country because of situations in those countries. And one of the things I found that was really fascinating was that when it comes to the Afghan refugees and the thousands of people that are going to be resettled in this country, 73% of Americans actually approve of them coming to this country. And that not only in most instances previously had there been more people opposed than support of refugees, but this was actually almost a consensus. Majority certainly of Democrats and independents, but even nearly half, I think, believe the plurality of Republicans agreed.
Yeah, Republicans were 49-44 on that. And that's interesting because mm-hmm. I think Afghanistan as an issue, no matter what happens in this enduring, ever-changing news cycle, the next issue in Afghanistan is clearly going to be refugees. It's been, the conservatives have been out in front on that. And it's odd, in this case, conservatives have been painting this as a, you know, bad issue for Democrats. Don't let these immigrants in. They're going to bring terrorism and all that. And you got 49% of Republicans as a plurality saying, yeah, they should be resettled in this country. I think there's a disconnect there on the conservative side.
Yeah, and look at these numbers, and I guess it's the final point on this section, but the if you looked at all the numbers on Afghanistan and then said, well, who is responsible yeah. for the shortcomings? You would think the answer was Joe Biden. And yet, when you talk about the overall policy and the shortcomings of Afghanistan, George Bush shows up as being the plurality of the fault. And so counter to what we're saying about the immediacy of everything, some things do last for a while. This was
although that there is a partisan, there's yes. a partisan divide there. Republicans think that Presidents Obama and Biden are responsible, and Democrats and independents point the finger at President Bush. And less so Donald Trump. But moving along to another issue that we've been tracking, COVID. And we had some interesting changes this time around. Surprising, I think a bit surprising, given that we thought that vaccinations had plateaued. What were some of the findings that, you found?
Well, I think the big one was that there was an increase in 5% from last month. Just in a month's time, of people who were they will or have gotten the vaccine, and encouraging, I think, to this is also that most people who've gotten it say they will get the booster. So I think we're kind of moving, turning the page slowly on this, and getting to a point where there's a change, you know, kind of like a acceptance to. The vaccine. I thought one thing I thought was really very interesting in these numbers. When you look at the regions, the four regions that we polled, the South was the place that had a significant change in a reduction of the, you know, the resistance to this vaccine. In other words, more people willing to go ahead and get vaccinated, already have or willing to. And I think that really speaks to, you know, the steady drumbeat of information that, you know, a surge is occurring, the ICU, you know, hospital beds are full, you know, if the masks are not being worn, you know, then, you know, you're asking for trouble. I think we're seeing that that has punched through in a significant way in this number. So I thought it was very interesting.
Although I don't think we know why. We can, we see what's happening, but there is some question about whether it's that, whether it is mandates. You know, you can't go to work if you don't get vaccinated.
Yeah, true,
things like true. That. I think there's some question about that. Although my guess is it's a little bit of everything. Two things stood out to me in the COVID part of our survey. One was the employer mandates, the acceptance of that or the support for that flipped. It was 50 against, 44% in the last poll in July that supported it. Now it's 50-44 the other way. So I think there's been movement there. And then there's been movement also on this question of schools too, where 65% of Americans are now supporting schools requiring students for masks for students and staff. That's big because that's a big battle that's going on. We hear about these local school boards and we see YouTube videos of people screaming, yelling at these poor school board members. And yet, you know, nearly two out of three Americans support the idea that, yeah, let's get the kids back in class and let's put masks on them.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that stood out to me is not only did we see the increase in vaccinations, but we also saw a decrease in the number, or at least the proportion of people who said that they definitely would not get the vaccine. And so that's down to fewer than one in five Americans at this point. Another positive too is that 81% of people who are fully vaccinated actually say they will get the booster when it is made available to them.
So we wanted to circle back on something we have talked a lot about on this podcast, the U.S. Census, and talk to a guest that we had on back in 2019 when there was a lot of questions about what the census would look like under the Trump administration, especially around questions of asking about citizenship. And we had Hansi Luong, national correspondent for NPR and kind of the census guru over there, on to talk about that. We wanted to talk about an article that he wrote very recently and how that may affect polling. But before we get to that, Hansi, welcome, and tell us about what you've been reporting on the last 24 hours. You've been on NPR a lot with news about the census.
Thank you for having me back. The latest in this saga over the former President Donald Trump administration's failed push for a census citizenship question is that there's been a very long legal battle over redacted internal emails and other documents I'm in New York City, so you might hear some horn honking, some sirens in the background.
We like ambient noise.
Okay. And there's been a long battle over these redacted documents, emails that the Trump administration blocked members of Congress, specifically the House Oversight Committee, from seeing as part of their investigation, trying to figure out exactly what was driving Trump officials to push for this question. And the latest is that under the Biden administration, the Justice Department has entered into an agreement with attorneys for Congress, the House Oversight Committee. And it seems that the Biden administration is going to allow lawmakers to take a look at some of those internal emails. And that may ultimately resolve this very long-running legal dispute. And we may get a little bit more insight into exactly what was driving the Trump administration's push for a citizenship question. My reporting so far has highlighted that, you know, there's been a lot of talk that this may have been motivated as a way to discourage specifically households with non-citizens, and particularly Latinos, Asian Americans, from participating in the 2020 census. That's one theory out there. There's also another theory that this was an effort to produce ultimately very detailed citizenship data, which could be used in redistricting. And GOP strategist Thomas Hoffler came up with a theory that this could give a political advantage to non-Hispanic white people, as well as Republicans, when voting maps are redrawn. And I've also highlighted that there's also been a decades-long push for a citizenship question in order to produce specifically a count of unauthorized immigrants in the country. And that would be used by folks who've been wanting to do this for decades, mainly from Federation for American Immigration Reform and other groups that have been against increases in immigration in the country. They've been wanting to have a number of unauthorized immigrants in order to radically reshape how Congress, how the Electoral College, as well as how public policy is set in this country.
So more to come on that, obviously, as you are able to see what is in some of these emails. Let's switch gears to an article that you wrote recently, though, about the census as it has been delivered. We actually have results now. And one of the big headlines has been, there are far fewer white people in America than there were in 2010. And that's not entirely accurate. We're interested in this because it has a lot to do with what we do as pollsters. Let's talk about what you wrote in the article and what you found in as to what some of the causes are for the changes in the apparent changes in the demographic makeup of America.
Sure. I think the first thing to keep in mind here is, how are we defining white? Because I think I'm saying the obvious. Race is complicated in the United States of America. It has been since the very founding of this country. And the census has been the main way for producing this race data that today is used in so many different ways, including for polling, but also for redrawing of voting maps once a decade at every level of government, for Congress, state houses, local government, for guiding the distribution of federal funds, and also for research and planning over the next decade. And there's been a lot of reporting about what these 2020 census results say about how the quote-unquote white population has changed. And a lot of that analysis, the headlines you may have seen, may have oversimplified the story. It's a complicated story. And again, it goes back to, how are we defining white? Because we can't forget that the census forms, the 2020 census forms, as well as the 2000 and 2010 census forms, asked the question of, well, what is this person's race, essentially? And also included instructions that says mark one or more boxes.
Now talk a little bit about how that has changed over time, because this has been you know, a long running issue in the census. You know, certainly we're experience right now exactly, you know, the how we may be asking this differently even in the future. But talk a little bit about how it actually has evolved as a question in the census.
The race question, you mean?
Yes, yes.
There's been a change every decade. The census, the U.S. Census has not asked about race in exactly the same way. And I think the thing to keep in mind is that since 2000, respondents were able to check more than one box in order to answer the race question. And it's only been since 1960 when every resident in the country was able to self-identify their racial identity. Before 1960, it was a member, it was a government worker who was charged with determining a person's race, which could have matched how a person would identify their race, and maybe a lot of times did not at all. And so I think this is all really important context to keep in mind and when we analyze these new race data, because it's a lot more complicated than what you may see in the headlines.
So fast forward to 2020. As you've both mentioned, that you know, we have seen the headlines that that the country is changing, but our language is also changing. And there's a movement to even change how we talk about, how we describe race in the United States and the concepts of majority and minority and the implications that has.
Right, there are ongoing conversations. And in some ways, I think what we're seeing is the country, the news media, my industry, you know, catching up with changes that have been in place again since 2000, that the race question has allowed multiple options in order to capture a better portrait, a more thorough portrait of an increasingly multiracial population. And also a population that isn't necessarily going to have a numerical majority or minorities per se, that framing may just may not really be the best way to describe changes by in the population by race, that a lot of demographers are looking ahead and seeing that the way the trends are playing out, there could be a time when we're looking at pluralities and that no one racial group would be a majority. At this point, according to the 2020 census results, the largest racial group is still the white population. And if you want to talk about how that white population has changed, I think we have to be specific if we're talking about folks who only checked off the white box or folks who checked off the white box in addition to other boxes in answering the race question, because there is no one definition of white. There hasn't, and there never has been, but the way that the census data has been interpreted by a lot of people, including folks in the news media for decades, is that white is synonymous with what the Census Bureau has called the non-Hispanic white alone population. That is people who only checked off the white box when answering the race question and said that they did not identify as Hispanic or Latino. And that is certainly has never been the case of necessarily of who is white, but that has been how census data has been interpreted by a lot of people, including today.
I mean, one of the challenges we face in polling is that we depend on the census data to kind of have the baseline, right? It's hard to extrapolate from any sample that we do, any polling that we do, without knowing, well, okay, so what is the population of the U.S.? That's fundamental to what we do and what social science research, so much of it does. How does that change what we do? I mean, do we need to change the way we ask those questions beyond what the census has asked? Do we need to stop identifying? And I don't mean just polling, but in general, does this point to a place where instead of identifying how many people are white or non-Hispanic, white or black or whatever, that we just don't identify by race? Or do we need to do a better job of identifying by race?
As a journalist, I wouldn't dare to tell what pollsters should or should not be doing, but I will say my reporting.
But you know this. Yeah, I mean, you've studied this deeply. It's actually great to get an outside perspective, what you think as a reporter, you know, social scientists, pollsters, survey people, what we ought to be looking at.
Well, what I can tell you is that I've learned through my reporting that how you ask a question, as all pollsters know, can affect the answers that you get. And especially when we're talking about something as complicated as race, as a person's racial identity, something that can be formed by so many different factors. It's not necessarily just a person's family tree. It also could be their skin color. It can also be how others perceive them, the level of discrimination they experience, the level of privilege they feel that they have, white privilege in particular. It's all these different factors. And a person's identity, racial identity, can change depending on how you ask, when you ask, and who is asking. If it's the government asking through the census form, a person maybe give one answer, but when they're talking to their friends, to their family members, they may give another answer. When they're talking to a Marist pollster, they may be giving a different answer. When they're outside, just finished voting, they may give a different answer. So I think these are all the complications and nuances that we should keep in mind when we're looking at race data, that data is not produced in the same way. These data, including the census data, are produced. This is not bits of information that is just waiting to be collected. It is produced through decisions of how questions are asked. And also, as we see through the census, that an increasing share of the country is identifying as multiracial. One thing to keep in mind is when we were looking at race data from pollsters is, do they give the option for respondents to check off more than one box? And how do they deal with those? How do they process those responses? It's complicated. The Census Bureau has very complicated procedures for coding. And are there equivalent procedures and for polling, for surveys?
And the short answer is sort of, but not as complicated as the census numbers, simply because we can't ask as many follow-up questions in a interview as you can on a form for the census. I think sometimes online there are some researchers that do take the extra effort, but I am talking about the people, demographers, the polling community, and journalists. Is there something that we need to do about how we talk about race? And it's not the only demographic category. I think it applies to a lot of other areas as well. Particularly, I'm thinking back to 2016. When we talked about people with and without a college education. And it became demeaning, and it became a way of kind of carving up our different factions in the country. So is there a way that we need to change how we look at these demographic categories? And I think race is a good example because it isn't clear. And so maybe our conversation, we try to measure it to make sure that we are representing everyone, but are we actually doing more harm than good?
I'll speak as a reporter that every day I'm hearing more stories, more anecdotes, seeing more data that, again, racial identity is not static. And it is always changing, the ideas and concepts of race in this country. And there's no one idea, one conception, one shared definition. The Census Bureau's categories that it uses as prescribed by the White House's Office of Management and Budget also sparks a lot of debate. I'll give you two examples. The white definition that the Census Bureau has to follow according to Office of Management and Budget is anyone with origins in Europe, as well as Middle East and North Africa. And increasingly, we're seeing a lot of concern and a push from a lot of Arab American advocacy groups saying that this white category, I know that the federal government's definition defines people with Middle Eastern or North African origins as identifying as white, but a lot of people with roots in Middle East or North Africa do not consider themselves white increasingly. There are some who do, and there are a lot of folks who don't. That's just one example of how there is increasingly a disconnect. There's another ongoing debate about how best to collect information about people's Latino identity. Is it an ethnicity? Is it a race? And the federal government considers Latino identity an ethnicity. And that's why there is a Hispanic origin question. And that's why it's separate from the race question on the census forms. But on a lot of surveys, a lot of polling that asks about Latino identity as a racial category. And that opens up a really robust debate amongst the Latino population, where Latino identity is very, very complicated, where some folks may identify as Latino, but also identify as Black, as white, as Asian. And there are also folks who see some forms, including the Census Bureau's own form, where under the race category, under the race question, they don't see a Latino category, and they feel that this question, these categories, these boxes don't reflect the way they see themselves. And that's why at this point, the 2020 census says the second largest racial group in the United States of America is a group called some other race. I think these are all examples of how this is an ever-changing, ongoing conversation. And the Census Bureau has, this is always a challenge for the Census Bureau to try to keep up and to update its forms in order to best reflect the way people are thinking about their identities. And certainly this also means that it's a challenge for pollsters and other researchers who are conducting surveys when asking about race, how to keep up with something that is not going to stay the same because of changes in generational shifts and also the political climate and the social climate.
Hansi, a lot to chew on here for journalists and for social science researchers, for pollsters. There, as you point out, I think the most important thing maybe you said in this is an ongoing conversation. We don't have an answer, but it's a conversation we need to be having and all Americans need to be having too. This has been great. Really appreciate you coming on. Great article. We'll post a link to it in the show notes so that everybody can read what we've been talking about. And thanks again for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Check the calendar. August is done. Summer is moving on into the rear view here. And Labor Day, gosh. Well, what did we find in the fun fact? We found some numbers that were asked by 60 Minutes and Vanity Fair for CBS News in 2010. I think this is going to be a little controversial amongst ourselves, not too heavy a topic, but which best describes how you feel about Labor Day? It makes me a little sad because it reminds me that summer is coming to an end. Or it makes me happy because I look forward to the fall. I think I know some of your views on this, Barb. You're sad.
Oh, yeah. It's tough. It's tough. You know, once the temperature starts dropping, I do appreciate the cool breezes and the lack of humidity that we here in New York, signal the sign that summer has passed. But I wait all year for those wonderful months of summer.
Well, you really dislike the fact that it gets darker so much later. So much earlier.
Yes, as a lot of my friends say, I'm solar powered. So, you know, the more sun, the more energy I have. June 21st is a really tough date when the longest day of the year. And I know that days will be getting shorter after that.
Jay, how you scoring this?
I like summer. I'm definitely on the happy side because I love fall. And I'm going to guess because something else happens in fall that you are the same. But I'll let you answer that. It relates to our prior topics in fun fact.
Yes, yeah, so you're absolutely correct. Very, very insightful there. I like the fall. Why? Because it's football season. I wait all year for football season, and then it comes around, and then I kind of, you know, sad by about Christmas.
Christmas, Lee, you support, you root for the Giants, okay? You're going to be depressed.
I'm done by Halloween.
You're going to be depressed way, way before Christmas and probably before Halloween as well. We may not make it out of September.
But look at this, folks. The real numbers that Roper Archives provided us, the real numbers are, we're actually representative. We're typical.
It's true.
It's 2-1. 2-1 happy, 60% nationally to 30% sad, just like us. Jay and I, we're thrilled. Barb, sad.
Well, happy Labor Day, nonetheless, wherever you come down on this, right? Have a good weekend, a good Labor Day weekend, right?
There you go.
And that's going to do it for this edition of Poll Hub. Poll Hub is a production of the Marist Poll at Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York. I'm Mary Griffith, and Poll Hub's executive producer. Casey Schaff is our production supervisor. Ashley Marcinek is our production assistant, and Marcello Bettman is our trusted editor. Thanks to the Roper Center Archive at Cornell University. They provide us with the ability to look back at survey questions and results over the decades. If you have questions or comments, reach out to us on social media. We're at Marist Poll on Twitter and Marist Poll on Facebook and Instagram. And while you're at it, Check out our free series of short online learning modules. The Marist Poll Academy can be found on marispoll.com. Finally, if you like what you hear on Poll Hub, please consider leaving a review on your podcasting app of choice. Positive reviews help others find us. And while you're at it, go ahead and subscribe. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here next week.